Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Vanity Fair.
White Zimbabwe, here we come.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching, a weekly television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Hilary Bisis.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Chris Murphy. And we're here to discuss episode 3 of HBO's The Regime. It's called The Hero's Banquet.
Good evening and welcome one and all to The Hero's Banquet.
And later on, Guillaume Gallienne, who plays the Chancellor's husband, Nicky, will be here to talk about love, poetry, and living with Kate Winslet while filming the show.
But first, a quick recap. Under the influence of Corporal Zubak, the Chancellor is eating dirt and redistributing wealth through land reform.
You can't be Robin Hood and the king at the same time.
I can do both.
Chancellor Elena confesses to Zubak that she's stolen $1 billion from the people of the nation we're calling Genovia.
Thousands of fucking strings of money purloined from local businesses, farms, pension funds, just shit I can't ever unravel.
Elena begins to worry about what he will do with the information and fears his growing popularity. So she changes her mind on land reform and opts to annex Crimea. The Fabian Corridor.
Oh, and Herbert, we should send you out there. Give you a new title, something like Fabian Freedom Captain. Yeah, something like that. Something fun.
After spending time on the front line, Herbert returns to the palace for a hero's banquet. He learns of Elena's plans to cozy up to China, loses it, and is taken out of the palace in handcuffs.
Don't call me fucking ox! I'm not an ox, you hear me? Fuck me. The fucking ox!
No, you're a butcher!
So I don't know how you two are feeling, but I know this is only a 6-episode series, but I'm kind of surprised how quickly power dynamics are shifting. You know, yeah. And like, obviously, we're at the midway point, and I thought her casting Herbert out would be happening maybe in the second to last episode.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But here we are, it's happened now.
We are.
And how does he come back from this?
Does he come back? I would not be surprised if we don't see him ever again.
Oh, really? You think they would do that?
I know we haven't met Hugh Grant yet, so mm-hmm. there's...
That's true.
Oh, and I have a theory about that.
Okay. I have a theory, too. But yeah, it is moving... at, you know, quite a clip. Mm-hmm.
The time jumps are what's kind of taking me out, too, is that I guess they want to get past the... They want to get past the machinations and show us just the effects.
Right.
But it's been months between each episode.
Yeah, a couple months between each. And yeah, I guess they... Because
like, where are we? The House of the Dragon?
It's a good question.
Maybe each episode is going to be structured like, this is this era of this regime. This is the next mm-hmm. era of that regime. You know, I mean, obviously, I do feel like we're building to something. I mean, she's effectively become Putin.
Yeah, that really literally happened.
Well, with her legal annexation of their ancestral lands?
Yeah,
I don't
Crimea,
see a problem with this.
The Fabian Corridor. Or Crimea.
She's liberating the Fabians, I suppose.
Yeah, they were greeted as liberators.
Yeah.
Mission accomplished.
Yeah, that
right.
totally
well, I guess,
out.
Yeah, that's...
So the Iraq thing is what really jumped out at me about her plan to do what Daddy couldn't do. Like, that felt
of course.
Very, very Bush-esque.
Yeah, do you think Bush Sr. talked to his son like that?
Do I think he was a misogynist?
Well, yeah. Well, I just watched that Netflix show, The Octopus Murders. It implies bad things about George H.W. Bush. I'll tell you that.
Oh, my. Yeah.
You telling me the leader of the CIA was not a good guy?
Isn't that weird?
That's crazy.
We are really getting off track. I'm sorry.
No. My hunch would be that he's not gone for good, because I do think in that very violent, messed up scene where right before he's kind of expelled. Mm-hmm. I do, and then, but then she's kind of sad afterward. I was like, oh, is this like a sex game thing?
Well, it certainly seems that way.
Right, yeah.
There is a dom-sub relationship.
Yeah.
It kind of goes back and forth between who is playing what role.
Yeah.
Well, exactly,
Who's in control, who's...
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe she's like, okay, so I've made my point by having him hauled off by the military. I'll bring him back, mm-hmm.
She likes her playthings.
Yeah.
She's tired of him now, but he could...
And so because of that, I think that maybe it's a good thing for the pacing that he was kicked out, because it, implies that there are more twists to this than you... I mean, hopefully there are more twists to the plot than you would anticipate just from the basic setup of, like, oh, here's this guy who came from nowhere and is suddenly ascending through the ranks. Like, obviously he's going to have a downfall, and obviously he's going to somehow get propped up again. But maybe that accelerating in episode 3 means that there's, an extra twist to it that doesn't just kind of end up with him, like, in the seat of power.
Right. And I also think that, this episode in particular, obviously we see him be violent. He's not a stable person. Mm-hmm. But at the core of what he wants for the country is like, oh, poor people should get the money they're owed and should be treated fairly.
Yeah. Isn't that always the thing about communists?
Communists, like that.
Right.
When you look at it, you're just like, oh, wait, that does sound good.
But the execution, I think that's the main problem that I'm having with this show right now. Is who am I supposed to be rooting for?
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't need to have like a glowing, lovable protagonist, but Kate Winslet is turned into Putin, as we said, and her regime is going off the rails. He, while his heart is maybe in the right place, he's clearly got a lot of, weird, violent tendencies.
Yeah. And he's a psychopath.
He's a psychopath.
He's a strongman populist.
Yes. Strongman, oxman populist.
Yes, and you would have to think that, the Bloody Revolution, in which like the land is seized from the elites, it's not like that ends with this complete socialist utopia.
Yeah,
like historically speaking,
it hasn't happened yet, to my knowledge. So then you look at her cabinet. You got Nikki, her husband, mm-hmm. who with the Belize Fund, the holding company, they're all stashing money.
And he's a poet, so you can't trust him.
Exactly.
Yeah,
he might be the craziest one.
Oh, 100%. I guess it comes back to Andrea Riseborough.
She does seem like kind of the only.
I feel like I haven't really even spent that much time with her. All she does is sort of talk to her boyfriend every, open every episode and then check in once or twice. I'm just like, where am I supposed to be finding my sympathy? Where do my sympathies lie here?
Mm-hmm. I do think it's Agnes, and I think that her having her son essentially taken away from her at the end of this episode, maybe that's the thing that spurs her into action. Like, I think that maybe the show is about several revolutions that could be happening here, and I think that maybe she's one of them. She also has the ear of all the household staff who don't seem to be enjoying their jobs. A lot of them are getting fired.
That's true.
And she also has a sort of sensitive touch with Zubak. She doesn't like him that much, I think, but she kind of tends to him in a compassionate way. So I wonder, do they become aligned? Mm. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. He's too rough maybe for her. I don't know. But I do. I'm rooting for Agnes at the moment.
Yeah. Well, and she seems self-interested, but in a way that is, understandable. Really, right. She's, looking out for herself. She's looking out for her son. She maybe doesn't really care what happens to, the quote-unquote people out there, or she wouldn't be working in the palace in the first place.
That is true. We haven't really gotten to touch down with her, and maybe that's on purpose. I mean, she opens the whole show from the very first scene. She's the first person who says anything from a couple episodes ago. But I feel like I'm supposed to be rooting for her, and maybe it's my to Leslie bias, and I'm not over that situation. But I'm struggling with
what you're saying is that you are rooting for Viola Davis and the Woman King.
Exactly. That is exactly what I'm saying. Justice for Viola.
Maybe the Woman King will come sweeping into town, and
that would be a twist.
I'm open to
this whole thing was produced by Frances Fisher as an apology for that Oscar season.
I want to go back to her dream nightmare sequence with her father, kind of his reanimation.
Oh, God, can't you speak properly?
Stop saying that. I'm trying, Daddy.
You always just lie back and take it, don't you? That's why the Americans loved you. Are you going to take it from him? He has you sucking his cock, doesn't he? Answer, you ugly bitch. Pathetic.
That sort of, I don't know, there was a way in which that's like kind of putting too fine a point on it. Like, obviously she's damaged. Obviously she, you know, you have to have some kind of crazy, like, familial trauma to turn into this sort of political animal.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I also thought it was, like, a cool sequence, a horror element becoming more literal.
Yeah. Not that I was getting tired of the device of her visiting, you know, dead dad and giving a monologue that sort of shows all of her fears and all of her doubts to nobody. I really was sort of, taken aback when, you know, her dead dad called her a vapid, feckless, political whore with no principles. I mean, he really rips her a new one. And we're seeing, you know, the depths of her psychological damage and the trauma that has brought her to this point and how it's worse than I thought. By having it animated in such a way, it's like, oh, it goes really...
And I feel like internalized misogyny is also an interesting angle to approach, like, a female strong woman leader from.
Mm. Yes. And I think it's, like, it's helpful to get to know, like, what her life was like when this guy was alive, what maybe the nation's life was like when he was in power. The juxtaposition of that horrific scene where he's, you know, the zombie hurling horrible things at his daughter, and then a grand birthday party for him, and everyone's supposed to be celebrating this guy who is like a monster.
There's a cake topper of him in his coffin.
I did laugh at that.
That was like the kind of absurd touch that I almost feel like the show doesn't go far enough sometimes, and I think that like something like that, I want there to be more of.
Yeah, and I think this scene was a really good example of it really going there and being really sharp and really specific in its, you know, the internalized misogyny that she clearly feels, and using that to then weaponize her, being like, oh, like, my dad was mean, so I'm going to take the Fabian corridor to show him that I'm a strong woman. That was compelling to me, dramaturgically.
Yeah, no, and I think we also see her kind of veneer crack a little bit in the scene in the where they're training, and then she could, you know, falls to the floor and she confesses, like, oh, by the way, we've stolen $1 billion plus and it's in a bank in Belize, you know, whatever. And she genuinely seems not contrite about what she did, but at least, like, scared of how far she took things.
And sorry for being caught. She's not caught. I guess she's volunteering the information.
Right. And I think that she needed this sort of, like, aggressive, menacing presence of Herbert to sort of, like, say that out loud, because she and Nikki don't say that out loud. Like, yeah. I think even if Herbert hadn't been at breakfast and Nikki's kind of, like, hinting, like, you know, the Belize thing, I bet they kind of talk that way alone.
Oh, talk around it, of course.
She just needed to say out loud, oh, we stole so much money.
Yeah. And we're in a hole, and there's no way they can get, like, how do you get out of that? Especially when you bring in the land reform of it all, which, again, back to Zubak's, you know, heart being in a good place. I thought Nikki had a pretty good line where he was like, you can't be Robin Hood and also be stealing everything from, you know, all of your people. You can't have your cake and eat it too here. And I just, it's interesting, going back to the dad, Elena's relationship with her dead father, Kate Winslet told David that she sort of based the way that she talked on trauma, and she interviewed all of these psychologists and how trauma could, like, affect speech patterns and physically and emotionally affect somebody. And then having, like, heard that interview that David Canfield, our colleague, had with Kate Winslet, and then, like, looking at the way that she talks with, like, sort of the lisp, it's strong Margaret Thatcher, but it's also sort of childlike, like a little girl aspect of it, of her sort of...
She calls him daddy, right?
She calls him daddy all the time, and she's sort of doing this weird lisp and trying to sort of stiff up her lip, and it's not really working in that veneer. I feel like it gets more pronounced as she starts to lose her grasp more.
Whether the show is necessarily achieving its aims, I think we agree that Kate Winslet's really, like, giving a performance.
Yeah. And her performance in this episode really makes me maybe curious about what Elena was like when she was, like, a doctor living in Paris.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, because I remember, it's like, is it Assad, the son, who, like, left Syria, was educated very much in the West, and was sort of just, like, a normal rich guy and then went back home to take up his dad's reins and then became a horrible dictator. Like, I just think that's such an interesting, terrible trajectory. Mm-hmm. And I'm sort of starting to see Elena more in that vein. Not that I'm sympathetic to her, but it's like, I think she was a human being once.
Yes. And then
and we're seeing flashes of that and the way that she physically manifests her conflict in, like, the speech patterns and stuff like that. I think it's a layered performance that maybe is a little bit more complex than even the writing, you know, is, you know? Yeah. I think she's adding something interesting to proceedings.
Totally.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Because, yeah, you have Supak, what, he's literally making them eat dirt?
Yeah, with worms in
it. Right, right.
These French chefs making their little dirt piles.
Which is fun. I mean, coming from the creator of The Menu, a movie that I very much enjoyed, I think that's funny.
Yeah, and the,
but not subtle.
The mustard on the chest, you know, whatever that's supposed to do. I like that the absurdity of that, a sort of this world's version of wellness culture, is also then offset by the fact that, like, oh, no, Agnes's son actually, like, people actually will suffer from this. It's not some idiot dictator just, like, eating dirt because she thinks it's good for her. It's like, no, there are consequences that are really material here. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good balance for the show to strike. You know, for everything funny, there's something kind of dark to match it.
Yeah, dark and sinister.
For sure. Epilepsy does feel like one of those convenient dramatic diseases, though.
You mean in an action movie when there's a shot of a kid's inhaler in minute 10?
Yes.
And you're like, uh-oh.
Oh, God.
Something's going to happen there.
We're going to be in a fog. Yeah. No, it's like the second that you see him, I am still sort of, you know, I really thought that I understood that Kate Winslet was just kind of like playing whatever mommy when she felt like it but now she's saying,
co-parent.
Right. So what exactly is their arrangement?
She mentioned something about having fertility issues. It was episode 2, I think. In my mind, the history I've built for that is that Agnes was her loyal helper, you know, whatever. Agnes got pregnant with a boyfriend maybe that Elena didn't know about or something. And she basically was like, oh, great, you made a baby for me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing.
And maybe Agnes was not in a position to raise the kid without the financial support of Elena.
Right. Sure.
And that is another way that Elena has her claws in.
Does Elena have, like, legal rights over this kid?
Well,
I mean, I guess that doesn't really
matter.
She has
a dictator over everything. In the country. She has legal rights over the Fabian Corridor, Hillary. I mean,
she gets whatever she wants.
Yeah. The kid is the Fabian Corridor made manifest.
Okay.
I worry about the kid. When he had the seizure in this episode, I was like, I hope they don't kill him. That would be really great. But no, he's just like relapsing into these seizures and whatever. But I'm wondering how central the kid will become, and thus Agnes, to this sort of story. I don't think that Will Tracy, the creator, and the way this show is pitched, I don't think we're heading toward a sort of triumphant ending, you know? So I do worry about Agnes and that child.
Killing him feels like a bridge that's like, it's a cynical show. I don't know if
it's a mean.
I don't know if it's a sadistic show.
Right.
Well, I thought they were going to kill, and maybe actually at the end of this episode, he's dead, Bartos, the, you know, the richest man in Genovia, who, you know, last time we saw him, he was stacking chairs as punishment for, you know, various crimes that he may or may not have committed. Probably did, but who's to say? And now he's back in Elena's good graces again, you know, talking about the China deal and whatnot. I will say the show continues to subvert my expectations because I was like, okay, that's the last we've seen of Bartos. Like, she's now, you know, waging this war against the elite of Genovia. But one thing about the elite, they find a way of sticking around.
Oh, yeah.
They do.
She embarrassed him. That's what she needed to do. Mm-hmm. But he's still rich and she still needs him.
In the end, I think, she will toy around with Zubek and his populist ideas. And, as we have seen, then, go back to the way things always were and always will be, unless, you know, barring some kind of crazy upset. Speaking of, so at this dinner, this like big celebration.
But let's imagine how poor dear old Keplinger is feeling right now. And you know he's going to be watching this, folks. You know he's watching this up there in his mansion in the mountains, weeping into his Chardonnay.
That's Hugh Grant.
That's got to be Hugh Grant, the former chancellor, right? I think that's I think that's got to be
him. Because we haven't met him yet.
We haven't met him.
He's being invoked very consciously.
Oh, duh.
Yeah. I was thinking the same thing.
In my mind, though, I almost was like, no, but he's not like Eastern European Hugh Grant. It's like, Richard, none of these actors. They're all British.
Neither is gay.
Yeah, they're or French. Yeah. No, that's a great call because he has been invoked enough times mm-hmm. now that it's like Chekhov's Keplinger. You
totally.
Know, like we have to see him at some point.
We gotta see him.
Which is exciting. I mean, I'm curious what his sort of he was supposed to be kind of also feckless and what maybe not quite as bad.
Yeah. Well, she dethroned him.
Yeah. So I don't know if that means that he's, you know, on the more liberal side
was
of the spectrum.
Good?
Yeah. Yeah. Is yeah. there good? Who knows?
But he's rich.
Yeah.
Maybe this ruling class in this country, in Genovia, none of them are good. I mean, yeah. unlike our country.
And he's, I guess, he's been exiled somewhere.
Sure. Right. Yeah.
Nearby.
Yeah. So, okay. So maybe he could be, he's the kind of catalyst that pushes the show towards its end.
Yeah. In the second half. Yeah.
And it's revealed, I don't know, that he's the father of Agnes's child.
Yeah.
You've been reading the personal information section on Hugh Grant's Wikipedia page.
That is a trip. That is, if listeners have not read the personal life section of Hugh Grant's Wikipedia, please do yourself a favor. It is a roller coaster.
You know what I'm going to do after this?
So at this big party, there's a comedian on stage who's making jokes, you know, kind of like at the swells in attendance, and Elena's laughing, and Nikki gets pretty insulted about his poetry center. Zubak is getting angrier and angrier. He hears about this China deal or China brief.
China brief.
And
yeah.
She's like, oh, I'm assuming it's when we talk about China briefly, you know, and that then leads to them getting in this crazy fight that seems to end their relationship for now anyway.
Yeah.
And she does come at it and say it like, you want to sleep with me, don't
yeah.
you? You know, kind of going off of what her dad says about that, you know, mm-hmm. but she's kind of trying to like turn the power back on her side. And
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's, I don't find it erotic at all.
Yeah. Didn't turn
you know,
me
I don't
on.
Know if we're supposed to be a little turned on. I mean, Matthias Skarnarts is not a bad looking person and mm-hmm. nor is Kate Winslet, but like, I just find it all kind of depressing.
Yeah. I think.
And depressing that he falls for it, that he is goaded into. I mean,
right.
obviously,
he's
as
so
we've said,
gullible.
He's a very stable genius, but still, like,
yeah.
he does then, like, he attacks her in the way that she has been, like, goading him into attacking her. And, mm-hmm. you know, you see the satisfaction of, like, yes, he, like, fell for it. He, like, was as easily manipulated as I, like, wanted him to be.
Yeah, but again, that wasn't entirely so surprising to me because even from episode one, the whole, like, dream thing, like, she's always been like, I don't really know what we're talking, like, she's, like, going along with it, but I never really believed, at least in the last episode, that they were meeting in each other's dreams. It was clear that he had an infatuation with her.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one who's having wet dreams about her. He's doing his, you know, choky-tuggy thing, probably thinking about her, too, so it just seemed like he's they're both delusional, but she's not delusional about this. He's the one who's delusional about their relationship.
That's
yeah,
right.
And it makes, I mean, like, the way she had played along with the dream thing, and it was kind of foreplay, flirting, whatever, and then he brings it up again. As he thinks that he has this thing on her, mm-hmm. he thinks that, like, oh, I just go to that stupid dream thing, and then and she's like, oh, no, I don't believe in that. And he genuinely seems he's upset, clearly, that a means of control has gone away.
Yeah.
But B, I think he is, like, hurt. A
yeah,
little bit.
Because
he maybe enjoyed it. And he doesn't have any tenderness in his life.
Mm-mm.
And that was sort of the closest thing he had to it. I guess maybe Agnes is nice to him too. But.
Yeah, but not in the same way. And yeah, so I guess seeing that sort of reach its culmination or reach a boiling point. And again, I guess I don't want to say it was undercut by the fact that he had already been violent with her when they were working out.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
I wasn't like shocked that he would get violent with her again. It was, yeah, it was more.
She was provoking it because she yeah. knew he could get to that point. You know,
mm-hmm.
I think maybe that's one read you could have of it. Because after he leaves and she's sort of straightening herself back out, she doesn't look that ruffled. She kind of knew that was going to happen.
Yeah, and she sort of did that, I think, to justify getting him the fuck out of
right.
the palace.
Right, like, and then it's his fault.
Yes.
She didn't make that decision. He made
no,
that
he's
decision.
He's the one. He grabbed yeah. her. He did it. Which,
and yeah, yeah, and it's been building, you know, not only is she realizing that if she grants land reform, then she is personally screwed, but it's also
yeah.
like Zubak is like kind of becoming a joke around the palace at this point too. Like, I don't know if it was intended that the comedian making a joke about Zubak and him getting mad was like a callback to the White House Correspondents' Dinner that may have provoked Trump into running for office.
I mean, I think
that
we
does
can
come to mind.
Those illusions. Speaking of the political stuff, like the China of it all, China entering the picture as the U.S. kind of recedes from, you know, financial intervention and then or you know, investment, and then China, like that is very much a mirror of what happens in the real world, particularly on the African continent right now. Like a lot of Chinese money going in there because Americans just kind of gave up.
Yeah,
I mean, they haven't really given up, but like. Because like, you know, Will Tracy is a Succession person. That show is like a reference palooza to like topical things. This show is doing it less than I thought it would. Its world is more contained. Mm-hmm. Do you wish that it sort of looked outward more toward like our political world?
Well, I think we were sort of talking about this a little bit before we started recording in terms of there's a somewhat of a lack of sharpness in terms of what exactly Genovia is supposed to be and what exactly how it exactly fits into our geopolitical landscape. We hear it's like really close to Germany. We learn that this episode, which makes sense given, you know,
geography
giving us the Middle Europe.
You're drawing
Europe.
A map in the air.
Exactly, as I with my hands. But I find, and Kate actually in her interview was like, it's, you know, this is a fake world, it's imagined. It's like she very much seemed to sort of try to separate it from anything that's happening right now in our current landscape. But I do feel that because it refuses to sort of be very clear as to where it stands.
Yeah,
it loses a sharpness. It's not as biting as it could be about certain tensions.
Well,
yeah,
I think
because if the kind of takeaway is like autocracy is not good, then it's like
we sort of get that.
Yeah.
Well, and the thing is like. Okay, let's think if this, like, the show is set in the real world, right?
Yeah.
It's not like a fantasy alternative history except for this one country. Like, was this a Soviet bloc state? Like where did it fall during the Cold War? Like, because I'm picturing it as sort of like a little corner of Belarus, a little corner of Poland, of Romania. Those were all under communist rule. And so is that the history that we're supposed to be kind of building from? Or was it more independent? Like, I don't know.
And yeah, is it Hungary?
Hungary would kind of make sense, I guess, for that reason. And also because of who their leader is at the moment. So I know what you mean, though, that it's like, it's just off by enough of a little degree that it kind of starts to grate after a while where you're like, well, no, I really need more specifics about where we are.
Because if the writing and kind of the overall message and everything are like more finely honed, then like the little questions like that don't matter. Like you're just going to, you know, I'm thinking back to like the golden age of like Scandal, which like it's a fake presidency. It's a very different show from this.
Of course.
But you think about that, like they would like reference Ronald Reagan, but then they would also like have a fake Ronald Reagan, like in like the presidential line. And it's like, okay, that's like you can't have both of those things be true. Like you can't say the name Ronald Reagan and then have a fake president who was
basically
president
Ronald
in 19
right.
from 1980 to 1988 or whatever. But like. You don't care because it's such a wild ride and, like, it's so fanciful. And, yeah, like, if you can just kind of put that stuff aside, then I think that shows that the show is doing what it wants to do. Like, if the pedantic stuff isn't kind of in the back of your head the whole time.
Right. Yeah. Was it West Wing had fake presidents going back, I think, to Carter?
Oh, wow, really?
I think
that's
so.
And then Carter was real.
I might be wrong about that.
That's the future that liberals want.
Yeah.
They had a whole lineage. But, yeah, and I think that maybe— and this is maybe a problem of what I brought into the show expectation-wise, not what the show is actually doing, but, like, it's much more, like, a character piece than it is political satire. And I think—and there obviously is a ton of political satire in it, but it's more about these big performances and these quirky characters. And I think I maybe wish the balance was a little bit more in favor of the political satire. But, I'm thinking about, like, Wag the Dog— you know, that I don't know if that's probably before.
I've heard of it, but a little bit.
Like,
it is a little bit.
But that's
tell me
like
about
kind
it.
Of like walk and talk political, like kind of crazy. They create a fake war to kind of cover up a political scandal thing. Kirsten Dunst is in it. She's good. But that level of thing, whereas this is more The Favorite. Olivia Colman with some political intrigue in the background.
Which, like, totally. Succession, like, really walked that line so well.
Yeah.
Like, the characters were so... like, so specific and so unique, but also, like, the media satire was so on point.
So good. That also was more of an ensemble piece. I mean, this is really the Kate Winslet show, which I guess what I love, the Kate Winslet show. I love watching her get to do what she's done thus far, but I do feel because it's so Elena focused, and we do have, you know, Zubak obviously is like a big part of it, and, you know, we've got Agnes over here and Nikki over here, but it is so about Elena that it's a character study, but it's really just sort of about her. Again, like, we need to know about her past. We need to know about her trauma. It's all comes back to, like, the whims of, like, a crazy dictator. And, like, why is she the way that she is? And we haven't really gotten exactly there yet. And I'm finding it sometimes hard to engage because there's not that much there beyond that for
and with,
me.
Yeah, with a six-episode show, we now have three episodes
left. Halfway there.
Yeah, there's not as much time to kind of fill out the world, I guess.
You think about, like, the death of Stalin, the Armando Iannucci film, which is an obvious inspiration for this. I mean, Iannucci is, you know, looms over Succession, certainly. Yeah. That was a really, like, fleshed-out ensemble, even though there's, like, 18,000 actors in it, and they all have, like, two scenes each, if that. But you really felt like you knew everybody in a way. Mm-hmm. And I think this is, like, maybe the balance is off. Because what you have Kate Winslet doing a crazy performance. Yeah. Like, what are you going to do? Not going to have her in most scenes, you know?
And then but you have Martha Plimpton, who's here, and then, like, but will we ever see her again? Like, I don't, like, you know? It's like we've branched out, but it hasn't felt cohesive to me.
Yeah.
Which is maybe the point. And I mean, I guess it is like destabilizing the regime. You know, it's like maybe it's not supposed to feel.
But I feel like, I feel like Zubak can't be gone because then kind of where do we go?
Then where do we go? Yeah. Right. Then where do we go?
Yeah. I think we're halfway through now. I'm just ready to see like the kind of some glimmer of what the end game might be kind of on the horizon. Like I'm sort of, I want to see where the arc is bending to. Because.
To justice, of
we've
course.
Set the world. We've, you know, we I get it. Like, you know, and. Yeah, I mean, I guess that means I'm invested because I am eager to see what happens next. But I know I'm not good at predicting this show, certainly. Not that it's really asking us to, but yeah.
Yeah.
Still watching, we'll be back in just a moment. And when we return, we'll be talking to the Chancellor's husband. Actor Guillaume Gallienne joins us after the break.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the Reviews Director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
So, it seems like a pretty good deal being married to the Chancellor, right? I mean, you get all the dirt you can eat.
Better than that.
All the worms you want.
All the poetry centers you
can sleep in a different bedroom.
Yeah. I mean, I think that all things considered, it probably could be worse.
Yeah, it definitely could be. So it was so nice that we got to talk to actor Guillaume Gallienne, who plays Nikki, the Chancellor's husband. And he explained his relationship, his complicated relationship with Elena.
Gallienne is like pretty new to American television, but in France, he's like a really big deal, like theater performer, writer, actor, all
opera
the director. Yeah, like he mentions that in this interview.
Man. Mm-hmm.
A true classic Renaissance man. He's himself married to a dictator. No, I'm kidding. He's not. Chris and I did get a chance to talk to him about taking on this role. He was really enthusiastic about it. I think it's a really fun conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Well, we're so happy to have on the line Guillaume Gallienne, who plays Nikki on The Regime, a really fascinating, slippery character who seems to have a lot of shifting motivations. Guillaume, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you. I'm surprised you called me already by my nickname.
Oh, excuse me. That was probably informal of me, wasn't it?
Yes, actually, I would say as a consort, I would say Nicholas first.
Fair enough. So first off, I'm curious how this project came to you and what you made of it when you first read it.
So it came to me through Stephen's casting director, Leo Davis. And we met in Berlin when I was presenting Yves Saint Laurent in 2014. And since that, every year, Leo sends me an email saying, Guillaume, I've got this most amazing thing for you. And I'm never free because I'm doing a lot of theater here in France. Anyway, and this time she said, I've got this new thing. for the 9th time, and I read it and I adored it. I was shocked. I laughed a lot, but I was shocked by a lot of it. I was like, oh my God, how far is this going to be go? I mean, I had never read anything like that of the sort. And I knew it was Stephen Frears. And I didn't know about Jessica Hobbs yet, but I knew it was Stephen and I knew it was Kate. So I was already very excited. And I loved the idea of playing this consort. I thought it was a great thing to work on. How to? It's exactly I had a Zoom meeting with Stephen and Leo Davis. At the time, I was directing Cenerentola at the Opéra de Paris, and I was in my dressing room, and we did this Zoom, and Leo Davis said, "Oh my God, Guillaume, at last!" And I went, "Yeah." And suddenly, she just went, "You've got to press on the right button, Stephen. No, the right button." And Stephen Frears appeared in the Zoom and he said, "Hello, Guillaume. So how are you? What do you think of the part?" And I said, "Well, it's always interesting to play a consort because the real question is how to exist being one step behind." I said, "Yes, that's exactly how I would put it. Right. But where are you from?" And I said, "I'm from France." "No, you're not. I've never heard a French person speak English like that. You must be lying." And I said, "No, I'm not lying." And he said, "Right, anyway, but where are you?" And I said, "I'm at the opera." "The opera? What are you doing at the opera?" I said, "I'm directing Cenerentola." "Oh, my God, an intellectual." And Leo Davis just went, "He's exactly what you've asked me for, Stephen." He said, "What do you want me to praise you?" And that was it. I had the job.
Wow, that is absolutely incredible. I for one, I love that you keep referring to Nicholas as consort rather than husband, because that does seem to be more of his job. Their relationship, his relationship with Elena, is quite complex, and that power dynamic is completely there.
Well, yes. I mean, I'm sure that there is love. There must have been passion at first, because he left everything, his wife, his kid, he left everything. The way he says it is absurd.
Absurd.
I mean, he'd like, "Haven't seen them since, like, I've been a good boy." I mean, God, the guy is such a wally. Anyway, yes, I think it must have been passion, and then, time and power. And suddenly he's just, he's got one advantage that the others don't have, is that he's not scared of her.
Oh.
And that is a very important thing. He can actually say, he can speak the truth to her. But he's normally he knows how to deal with any fucking situation, because, I mean, she's so fucked up. He knows. But this time, something is starting to escape from him. And he's walking on eggs.
Why do you think he's not scared of her? Where is that sourced from? Does he implicitly trust her, or is it something else?
I think in a way there's trust. He knows how fragility. He knows really how fragile, how vulnerable she can be. That he knows, and she allows herself to be that vulnerable with him. So already they share this. And also, I think they share secrets, intimacy, obviously, and secrets. He knows her very well, and she knows that. And he accepts her. Not only that, but I think he has a bit of something. He's a bit of a masochist. I think he quite likes to be dominated by her. He likes to be her rug. And I think until she has met Matthias, Zubak, I think she kind of liked it. But now, meeting this really strong guy that is Zubak, suddenly she doesn't like it anymore. She doesn't want to have that rug anymore. She's not interested in having this dominated guy. She doesn't want to. I mean, she's intrigued about being dominated, I think, rather than dominating all the time. I think suddenly there's something reverse with the equilibrium of strength.
It's interesting, because Nicholas, he's able to use that in his favor. I mean, he's the mastermind behind The Foundling, basically bringing from the butcher to the foundling. And then that results in him, you know, consummating his relationship with his wife again for the first time in a year. So Nicholas seems to be winning due to the sudden rise of the butcher.
He's been there already. I mean, he's been there. He knows her. She's got suddenly, you know, she's turned on about something and she goes like, I mean, they're all very immature people. And I mean, I would say that the part played by Andrea Riseborough is probably the only one who's not totally immature. But if not, they're all very immature. Nicky in his own way, but not as immature as her. So he kind of, he knows her. He's been through that.
We see in episode 3, you know, that they're all kind of getting roasted at this, you know, a big event. You know, the poetry centers are sort of the butt of the joke aimed at Nicholas. How conscious do you think Nicholas is of the public perception of him? I mean, you know, I think one of the things we see when in stories where a man is married to a woman in power is there was always this question of like, is he somehow emasculated or anything? You know, I don't believe in that myself, but like, obviously it is kind of out there in the world. What does Nicky think about not his relationship specifically with his wife, but his relationship with the rest of the country?
That's the problem with Pratts, is that you'd never know how much they're actually perceived from reality. I think Nicky has a very narrow idea of reality. Nicholas is, he reads poetry, he's an intellectual, and at the same time, he just spends his day, you know, in the jacuzzi. And he is a bit of a prat. What he really cares about is really her. Is really staying with her, being with her. I mean, you know, having the power he has with the bank accounts and the secret things, and he knows how to deal with that. If not, he's very mundane. He's very, you know, he's got his friends all around Europe and he likes to be in his world. He doesn't care about the rest of the world. He's a selfish, he's really very immature.
Do you think he's a threat at all? I mean, there are people populating this show who, you know, could kind of cause some sort of danger to the country, to the regime, to whatever. Like, where do you see Nicky in that sort of hierarchy of like, should we be like worried about him lashing out or doing something really vindictive? Or do you think he's just too preoccupied to bother with that?
He's terribly vain. So I don't think he's that dangerous. He can be, because he's not stupid in a way. He doesn't know much about himself. He knows a lot about others. He understands others. He knows how to deal with others, but only once it's concerning him. He's, in a way, he's quite narcissistic.
Yeah. I mean, knowing a lot about other people is dangerous, you know, depending on how it's wielded.
Well, it's not dangerous because, he can be. I think he could be dangerous. But at the same time, he really loves her to have the power. I think it's really about her.
You think he truly loves her and doesn't miss his wife and his kid that he left behind all those years ago?
It's funny you ask that because I think he doesn't think about it like we would. Mm. I think he's like, everything's fine, you know, happily ever after. And he doesn't analyze it because he has no distance. He has very little distance. I mean, everyone in this palace has very little distance. I mean, they're really all like this, you know, obsessed by her.
Right, which is, you know, often in history how the aristocracy gets caught unaware because they don't see what's happening outside the palace or...
Aristocracy, all very powerful people.
Of any stripe, that's true. To talk about some more of the technical aspects of shooting the show, you know, you're someone who has an extensive career in the performing arts, and on this show, the live performing arts, I should say, and on this show, there are several scenes that you're a part of where there's a stage show happening, and you have Elena singing quite badly, and then there's a comic kind of roasting you all. What was it like, given your other job in the live world, to be part of shooting those scenes? Did it feel extraordinarily different, or did it kind of bring you back home a little bit?
What is great in the show is that we played in the dimensions of the sets where we were playing, whether it was on stage or whether it was in huge palaces in Vienna, or everything was very big. And this is why you also have very little close-ups. Everything is quite long, which is very clever. It brings the comedy, you know, as Chaplin was saying, you know, life is a tragedy in a close-up and becomes funny the further away the camera goes. And it's true that being able to play in those gigantic places, whether it's stages or huge dining rooms, and then you could emphasize the craziness of these people, because, you know, just playing breakfast, you know, in this huge dining room, like 300 square meters dining room in a palace, and just, you know, be focusing on the eggs, really, and, you know, playing the routine in this absurd place. That was really important for the comedy, because then we could be very sincere, very truthful in our little routine, and very grounded without even noticing where the fuck we were. And, you know, finding it totally normal. And this was emphasizing the comedy a lot. And we could actually be dark in the middle of this place, and that would make it even funnier. Yeah. I think the dark humor comes a lot from there. And that was very brilliant from the directors, not to go too close, but to allow us to be in those huge places. And
So much of that dark humor happens in interactions between Nikki and Elena. Can you talk a little bit about acting opposite Kate Winslet and how you sort of developed your rapport and your relationship off screen?
The big advantage with Kate Winslet is that every day, as soon as there was a new actor, she'd always take some time before shooting, before even rehearsing, so that, you know, just at the coffee table or whatever, just to put the person at ease, to say, hi, how are you? Yeah, I knew you were coming. And, you know, break the ice. And therefore, once we arrived on set, everybody was equal. It was just a teamwork. Now, her and I, we got along like this, straight away. I've been a big fan of hers since few years, because she's very young, but let's say quite many films. And I fell in love with her already when I saw Jude. Sure, yeah. And the first scene we had was in the car, and we laughed so much. We were laughing so much in this car that Stephen came to us and went, like, calm down, kids. But we were really laughing our heads off. And she said, I'm living in this house during the shooting. I've got this house. Come along. Don't go to the hotel. Come to the house. And so we lived together for quite a long time during the shooting. So we were sharing a lot, and, you know, and discussing the scenes and rehearsing scenes before, you know, the night before. And so we worked a lot together. And we had a great laugh. We got along very, very well. She's so honest and very clever. And she's very courageous. I thought this thing she does with her mouth is so brilliant, because she can turn off the sexiness and turn it back on in a second. And at the same time, it's a way of showing the fragility and how vulnerable this woman is. As soon as she's uncomfortable, her mouth immediately goes like this. And it's brilliant, because, it's really brilliant to do this at her stage of career, to suddenly... it's organic. She felt it like an obvious thing to do. And for us, it was like, my God, she's so crazy. And it's brilliant.
So you had a good laugh while doing the car scene. I'm curious, are there any other scenes in these first few episodes that in your memory stand out as particularly fun to shoot, or that you were,
Oh, God, yes. Yes. We had a big laugh with Matthias, because in this scene, I think it's episode 3, when he sniffs. And when I read it, I thought it was something very discreet. And so I'm there having breakfast in front of him, and suddenly he just went like this. And I just thought, and that made him laugh so much. He had all this ground this earth in his mouth, and he just went, like this, because he wasn't expecting my reaction, but my reaction came because I wasn't expecting his sniff. That was, I didn't expect it to be so large. Anyway, and no, we had big laughs when this Zubak comes into our bedroom to hit someone who, you know, who in the first episode he's on our bed.
The intruder, yeah.
Yeah. And he comes in and hits him, and they were talking about there should be blood and blood should come out. And so they were organizing this. And Kate and I were there on the bed. And suddenly we said, okay, let's prepare, okay, and shoot and action. And he came in and we were like, screaming our heads off like this. And him hitting. And they say, cut. And Kate and I were just like this. And we were, I didn't see any blood. Did you see the blood? No, I didn't. And we were like two extras, you know, playing Lord and Lady What the Fuck and going, I didn't see any blood. Did you see the blood? And anyway, so no, we were laughing a lot.
Well, I think that sense of play, but also serious craft comes through beautifully on the show. It really does feel like you and, you know, Nicholas and Lena have known each other forever. You and Kate have known each other forever. It just feels very organic.
I'm happy you say that. Yeah. Thank you for saying that. I agree. I'm very happy you say that because it's important to convey this sincerity of the couple.
I don't think the comedy would work as well without the without that truthfulness, you know.
Thank you. Can you come and give some classes to the French?
Well,
no, I'm joking.
Richard, on the podcast. Hey, look,
when the regime calls, I have to answer. Guillaume, thank you so much for talking with us and sharing these insights about the show. We're really enjoying it, and your performance is really exciting. So we really appreciate your time today.
Really wonderful.
You're very kind, both of you. Thank you very much.
Thanks again.
Still Watching will be back in just a moment. And when we return, we make our predictions for who will be the chancellor when it's all said and done.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so we are at our halfway point, as we've said. We have 3 episodes left. We have 3 episodes in our rear view. We are on the path to making Genovia great again, but who will be sitting in that moldy, moldy palace when the curtain falls?
Whoever comes closest to guessing who the new leader of Genovia is at the end of the season will win a one-way plane ticket to Turkmenistan. Well, actually, we haven't decided. Is it one way or a round trip?
I think one way. If you want to come back, you got to figure that out yourself.
I think we're going big or going home.
Yeah,
we're going big or going to Turkmenistan.
Yeah. Before we issue our predictions for this week, just a reminder: last week, Hillary said that the country would become a friendly American puppet and a CIA plant would be the head of the country. Chris said Agnes, and I said something similar to Hillary, which is the U.S. Like, the U.S. just takes over the country. But now, feels different.
We've kind of pulled away from that.
The U.S., I don't feel...
I think, I forget his name, the billionaire.
Oh, Bartos.
Bartos. I think him, because that'll be the show being like, and then Trump. Like a billionaire took over, you know. Like let's just like give up and just have a company come run this country.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think.
Fair, cynical, fair, makes sense. I think we haven't even met him yet, but I'm going to go with Hugh Grant. I think he's the chancellor. I think he's the former chancellor. I think there might be a regime change that brings us back to the old regime. I think maybe Elena gets the boot. Elena has to flee. The Belize Fund comes out. It all, you know, it comes crashing down. And they turn to the last leader.
Like he's like Napoleon on Elba and he's just like waiting in the wings.
I'm going to go with that's it. This is assuming that Hugh Grant is the character that we decided that he was, because we don't even know if he is this character. So
we don't know.
But
maybe he's playing Tony Blair. We don't know.
We really don't.
But he's an Oompa Loompa.
Yeah.
He's a very unhappy Oompa Loompa.
That's
the Oompa Loompas are from the Fabian Corridor. Yeah.
If this and Wonka take place in a shared universe,
sure,
then it's all worth it.
Yeah, it's true.
We're leading up to the moment where Timothy, you know what? Yeah, so I'm going to say it. Timothy Chalamet
as Wonka
is going to win.
Not as Paul Atreides?
No, not as Paul. If you've seen the second movie, then you know that you probably cannot trust him. Sorry, no spoilers.
No spoilers, but...
I don't...
We have you down as Timothy Chalamet, so we're just.
I guess that's all right. Fine, that's what I'm. That's what I'm.
Deus ex Chalamet. No, that gets me Chalamet ex Machina.
Doopity doo.
Well, that does it for this episode of Still Watching. Please, if you have any theories, questions, anything like that, you can email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. We sometimes read emails on the episode. So, you know, again, that's stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. And you can find me on various social medias at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S. And I said medias.
Medias.
Sorry.
You are forgiven. And you can find me on those same social medias at Christris.
And I took Latin, and so I will not forgive either of you. Media is the plural of media, and you can find me at Hillabuster.
This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our producer is Emily Elias, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes. We were engineered and mixed by Jake Loomis. Steven Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back next Sunday for episode 4. Looking forward to seeing you then.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.